This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street all across the state this time of day. Those real Main Streets that are the centerpieces of our communities are important places where we meet and greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds. And these days we might be talking about the weather because we've been through a cold snap. But that's the weather, and we're actually going to talk about climate today with somebody who's interested in maybe affecting climate. His name is Douglas McMartin. He's a principal investigator and a senior research associate in the mechanical and aerospace engineering area at Cornell University, and he joins us from there. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, let's get a little background first. We know that some people might be skeptics about global warming, but most scientists are pretty much convinced that it's underway and will have some very serious consequences. So give our listeners the current status of our warming planet.
So we're about a degree Celsius, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, warmer than pre-industrial, and that's almost entirely due to basically burning fossil fuels and adding CO2 to the atmosphere. And the physics of that is all mostly dates back to the 1900s, late 1900s. So there's not really any dispute at all about the fact that burning fossil fuels adds CO2 to the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, that causes the planet to warm. And then the question basically is, what are we going to do about that and how bad is it going to get?
Well, there are visible effects of global warming, at least to my unprofessional eyes. I've seen a curb that literally separates a suburban Long Island community from the Atlantic Ocean, or the Sound at any rate. We've seen water moving into South Miami. What other elements or ways do you, when people ask about climate change, you say, well, this is hard evidence?
So we're certainly seeing, in terms of impacts, we're certainly seeing increases in forest fires, increases in drought, slight increase in sea level rise, melting ice from glaciers and so forth, hurricanes getting detectably stronger. So there's a long list of impacts that one expects from a warmer world. In terms of the fingerprint of saying that's unequivocally due to human emissions of fossil fuels, human emissions of CO2 from burning fossil fuels. That's partly two things. One is that's exactly what you would expect to happen just from basic physics, that we know carbon dioxide absorbs infrared energy coming from the Earth, so it makes it harder for the heat to heat to escape. Basically the same thing as putting on a sweater. So you'd be really, really surprised if increases in CO2 did not cause the planet to warm. And at the same time, there is no other explanation that anybody has ever come up with that's consistent with the data. So for people have said things, the sun might be varying in intensity, but we have measurements of that. And we also know that if the warming of the planet was coming from changes in the solar intensity, that would actually affect the climate differently from the way that CO2 affects the climate.
Well, recently you've been making headlines for talking about something that uses the term geoengineering. Here's one headline from November of last year. Geoengineering might address climate change, McMartin tells Congress. What is geoengineering?
So to start with, I actually don't really like the word myself, but we're kind of stuck with it at this point. So the main way of addressing climate change is simply to reduce how much fossil fuels we burn, reduce how much CO2 is in the atmosphere. But that's slow. You know, we can't just turn off our entire Western energy system and switch it over to renewable energy instantly. And so the expectation is that climate change is going to get an awful lot worse before we're able to fully stop our carbon emissions. So there's two other ideas that have been floated that one could use in addition. One is to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere after it's already there. And the second is to reflect some amount of sunlight away. And so if you reflect a bit of sunlight away from the planet will cool off. And the easiest way to do that would be to put aerosols, so very, very small, tiny droplets of liquid or solid, very, very high into the atmosphere, and that we know that that would reflect sunlight and would therefore cool the planet. We don't really know all of the other impacts that that would have, and it would be a terrible idea to do that instead of cutting carbon emissions. But doing that in addition to cutting carbon emissions might actually reduce a number of the impacts of climate change.
And we were all reminded of how this impact might actually take place by a recent eruption on the island of Bali, part of the Indonesian nation, Mount Agung. It erupted. And what happens as a result of a volcanic eruption that's important to geoengineering?
So the Agung hasn't yet had a really massive eruption. And the atmosphere, there's multiple layers in the atmosphere, but the area that we live in is referred to as the troposphere. And that's very turbulent. There's all this convection and storms and clouds. And anything that you put, if you dump pollution into the troposphere, most of that just rains out pretty quickly. But if you go high enough in the atmosphere, you get into the stratosphere, so named because it's stratified. The air is stable. And if you put material way up into the stratosphere, it will stay there for a year or two. And so if you get a sufficiently large volcanic eruption, so the last really big one was Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991, and when that erupted very explosively, that put something like 30 megatons of sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere where they circled the planet for a year or two, and that actually cooled the planet by about a half degree Celsius. So we haven't yet So far, Agung has had a relatively minor eruption from an atmospheric perspective, but there's still pressure building up, and if it does erupt massively, it could easily put substantial material into the stratosphere that would again cool the planet. The last time Agung erupted was, I believe, 1963. That was before we actually had good observations of the climate system to monitor exactly what it was doing.
There was a famous explosion in that part of the world back in 1883 when Krakatoa exploded, and supposedly that sound was heard around the world. I wasn't around, so I don't know. But there were effects of that that people experienced who were nowhere near Krakatoa. So what we're looking at here is something that is monumental in its scope to get all of this material into the stratosphere. How might we do that without a volcano?
So the basic idea is to mimic the volcanic eruption, and you could almost certainly get the amount of material that you need up there with aircraft. We don't have any aircraft that exist today that could do this. Any of the aircraft you see flying just don't fly high enough, and the only airplanes that can fly high enough, some of the military aircraft, just don't have enough payload capacity. So you'd have to specifically design an airplane to do this, but it's not fundamentally a difficult thing to do. And so in principle, if somebody had, I don't know, maybe it's $5 billion, maybe it's $10 billion, you could develop an aircraft and start bringing sulfate material up into the stratosphere where it would cool the planet. The hard part is, you know, a few billion dollars in the grand scheme of things really isn't that much money. So we certainly could do it. It's very unclear whether we should do that or not.
Uh-huh. So let's talk about unintended consequences here. What are some of the things that might happen?
So there's two broad categories. So one thing is the only reason to consider doing this is to deal with the consequences of climate change from increased CO2. But if you warm the planet by adding CO2 to the atmosphere and then you cool it by reflecting the sunlight away, those two don't affect the climate in quite the same way. And so there are other changes in the climate system. So you'll bring the temperature down, but you'll also affect precipitation patterns in slightly different ways, for example. So some places might get a little bit drier than they would otherwise have been. The second sort of category of things is that you put stuff up into the atmosphere, eventually it's going to come down, and that will have some small health impacts. And if you put stuff in the stratosphere, that also will affect the ozone hole. So we've all heard about the ozone hole as well. Mm-hmm. That's primarily caused by chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, and the like, chlorine compounds that we used to put into the atmosphere in large quantities. And as long as those are still up there in the stratosphere, then any aerosols we add to the stratosphere will actually help that chemical reaction that destroys ozone and will reduce the amount of ozone we have.
Well, given those issues, how realistic do you think this kind of intervention is?
I guess I would hope that nobody would seriously consider this today. I mean, in some sense, nobody can seriously consider this today because we don't have any way of actually doing it. The hard part is depends how bad climate change gets. Mm-hmm. So right now, if you look at the so, for example, the Paris Climate Accord that was signed a few years ago, that suggested that we should try to limit the warming of the planet certainly below 2 degrees Celsius, which would be 3.6 Fahrenheit, and preferably well below that. But at the same time, we don't actually know how to do that. And the best estimate is that we're probably going to head for something closer to 3 degrees Celsius, so about 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and maybe even more. And we don't really know what the consequences of allowing the planet to warm that much are. And it's quite plausible that it would be better to not let the planet get that hot. If you said that amount of warming is going to destroy crops in India, that amount of warming might melt substantial parts of Antarctica and lead to several feet of sea level rise, you might say, yeah, maybe I'll take a little bit of loss of ozone hole and a slight change in precipitation patterns because it's better than not doing it.
Well, this is a great example of how the world has to work together eventually, and we're probably not there yet. Would it ever be possible for, you know, a United States or a China to invest billions of dollars and just do something unilaterally, the rest of the world be damned?
So, yeah, so this is probably actually much scarier than any of the climate impacts. I suspect that the actual physical climate impacts of doing geoengineering might not actually be all of that bad. The really scary stuff is more the geopolitics of it, is, you know, just exactly what would happen if one country decided to do this. Because there's no way, you can't just geoengineer the climate of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you do is going to affect every single person on the entire planet. And there's no, we don't really have good international institutions today to figure out how to make those types of decisions. And so you can imagine the worst possible outcome would be some country decides to do it. If there's any weather event the following year, if there's a drought in some other nuclear-armed country, they're going to blame that on deploying the geoengineering, regardless of whether one can actually do a scientific attribution of that. And you have the potential for much, much more serious effects than the climate consequences in the first place. So it's a really, really hard question, is how do we develop the international capability to make these international decisions?
Well, I was struck by one of these articles which referenced the research that is currently underway, which is funded in part by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, better known as DARPA. That's sort of that kind of dark area in the budget, apparently, where money goes to fund things that are considered critical to national defense.
So I actually did receive some funding from them. As you might expect, and pretty much my reaction as a taxpayer would be, I would really hope that the U.S. Defense Department is aware of and actually has some understanding of this, because probably one of the biggest threats to U.S. national security in the next century is going to come from climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So you see what happens to the world with a few million refugees from Syria. What would happen if you have a massive agricultural failure and famine and you have 100 million or 500 million people who are refugees wanting to relocate somewhere? So in that sense, I'd actually really, really hope that the great minds in our Defense Department are at least want to be informed and have some idea of what the options might be to available.
Well, it does beg the question in a sense of should the Global Village have a meeting? I mean, is there currently any international body that is considering geoengineering or active intervention?
No. That's an easy question. So the closest place would be the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, as it's referred to. So that's the organization that has a meeting every year, and the organization responsible for the Paris Climate Accord. And geoengineering is not yet on the table there. I think the biggest concern right now, well, there's two big concerns. One is the concern that if we talk about geoengineering, some people might go, oh, great, we have a technological fix. We don't need to cut our carbon emissions. And so there's a concern that even talking about this will make, in some sense, make climate worse.
That's a conundrum because there's also a concern that talking about it makes you sort of politically untouchable in some circles as well.
Yeah.
So a bit of a complication there.
Yeah. And my reaction is simply we need to make sure we're informed. We need to do the research to understand this because right now we don't have anywhere near enough understanding of what the impacts of doing this would be or of exactly how one should best do this. We don't even really understand how uncertain our model predictions are right now. So we need to do the research to make sure we're better informed. I think the worst possible case would be that we don't do the research and something happens 10, 15, 20 years from now and somebody says, oh, wow, this is terrible. Let's start doing geoengineering without having actually done the research to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, the easy decisions are right now. The easy decision is should we be doing research or not? The hard decisions are going to come in 10 or 20 years.
Well, those hard decisions will probably come about because people who are currently not convinced necessarily, scientists may be, but people at large are somewhat questioning this. But in 5 or 10 years or 20 years, there will be such obvious impacts of global warming everywhere that there may very well be this kind of sea change. What are we going to do about this kind of thing?
I think that's inevitable. I think you're already starting to see that shift in public opinion, at least. The public understanding of climate change actually is better than that of some of the political leadership in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But in pretty much every other country in the world, this isn't even a subject of debate. It's just basic science.
Well, when we look at a climate map right now, we'll see that there's sort of a blue streak through North America, that is Canada and the U.S., but the rest of the world looks pretty warm.
Yes.
So the anomaly is right where we are, that is me right now. But global warming is still registering everywhere around the world.
Yeah, well, it's pretty damn cold here right this instant. And you certainly see every time it's cold, somebody will say, oh, see, global warming's not real.
Well, but the president just recently said that, yes.
But, you know, they don't turn around 6 months later and go, oh, it's hot, therefore global warming is real. You know, the important thing to keep in mind is that these are – global warming is referring to – well, first of all, the globe. It's the average over the entire planet. And it's referring to much longer timescales than any individual season or weather event. So – of course, it's still going to get cold from time to time. Although, you know, I grew up in Ottawa in Canada, and we pretty much always got to minus 40 at least once a winter. That's sort of what I remember as a kid. And that, you know, the cold snaps aren't quite as cold as they used to be. And the heat waves in the summer are a little hotter than they used to be. And if you're a chunk of ice in Antarctica, you'll respond to that and you will melt.
Well, I've been around this part of the world since the middle of the 20th century, and I can tell you it is not as cold as it used to be when I was a kid. So that's my two cents. Yeah. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Douglas McMartin is a scientist and researcher at Cornell University looking at engineering climate change, a process called geoengineering. Coming up next on Main Street, a commentary from UND Professor Mark Trahant.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a consumer-owned power cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with more than 30 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota. Outside the classroom, he's still a practicing journalist and the author of the online commentary Trahant Reports. The new year starts with all sorts of resolutions, and one issue that's been put off for a later day is a resolution about how the federal government spends money. That later day is January 19th, and federal spending is the topic of today's Trahant Reports.
Government budgets are policy documents. What programs are more important and therefore get more funding? Which agencies should get less? The Trump administration has been clear since the election that it wants smaller government. But Congress, not the president, makes that call. And that's where the problems begin. Congress is supposed to enact spending bills by October 1st, but the votes are not there to make that so. Some conservatives want the federal government to spend far less across the board, while others want more money for defense. Neither of these wings has enough votes to pass their spending plan, so they need help from Democrats. And Democrats are against harsh budget cuts in domestic programs. So instead of a spending plan, Congress has been enacting short-term budgets. The latest temporary bill includes money for the Children's Health Insurance Program, and that includes insurance for American Indians and Alaska Natives. That program expired in October. But Congress has avoided most of the contentious issues that divide Republicans. The leadership says it will address immigration, health care, and national security in the next spending bill. Right. Over the next year or two, there will be much more pressure for Congress to cut the budget. Deeply. The new tax law means there will be fewer dollars going into the federal treasury. Roughly $1.5 trillion less. So the White House is already telling federal agencies to prepare for severe budget cuts in the 2019 budget. A memo recently surfaced that called for a government-wide pay freeze, just to save money. The Washington Post reported that federal employment has dropped by some 16,000 workers. That's a small percentage, but it includes the slow appointment of political posts. The president is choosing not to fill many slots. And it masks even deeper reductions in agencies such as the Environmental Protection Administration or the Internal Revenue Service. The president is, quote, committed to streamlining government for the 21st century, reducing bloat, duplication, and waste, and focusing resources on key priorities like public safety and protecting our nation's homeland, unquote, a White House spokesman told the Post. The president is shrinking government, as he promised. Congress is governing at short-term intervals because there are not enough votes to pass a real spending bill. And that's not a good sign going forward, because the budget only gets more complicated because of all the issues that Congress has been avoiding. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can read Mark Trahant's blog online at Trahant Reports, that's T-R-A-H-A-N-T, reports.com. Coming up on Main Street, the 13th annual Blizzard Bluegrass Weekend is this weekend in Bismarck. We'll talk with Jill Weiss, one of the organizers, about that. And horticulturist Ron Smith will tell us what we can do about our plants and our plans for our plants in the dead of winter. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. An interim legislative committee is studying North Dakota's early intervention system for kids with developmental disabilities. The committee is looking at the funding sources for that system, as well as how families are able to deal with the system.
These are the sickest, most vulnerable children in North Dakota. That's who these 3,000 kids are. They're your kids with congenital heart defects. They're kids with pre-diagnosed conditions. They're very sick.
Roxanne Romanek of Bismarck is a member of an early intervention task force. She says the problems for parents is often trying to deal with the assistance forms and the levels of bureaucracy.
If it was streamlined in the system, so I'm just dealing with one person and one entity instead of two, would be glorious if that happened.
Romanek says she hopes the system will be a test case for the Department of Human Services, which is trying to redesign how human service programs are delivered in North Dakota. Time runs out after tonight for the use of the National Guard Armory in Moorhead as an emergency homeless shelter, but another overflow site has been found. Working with city and county leaders, emergency managers, and other shelters in Fargo and Moorhead, Dilworth says it will open its community center for use starting tomorrow night. This is Mayor Chad Olson.
We're being mindful of our responsibilities, not only, you know, to the tenants, the renters of the community center, but that we're also being mindful of our role in the community. And again, my hat's off to the staff. It's really working diligently to make this happen and happen soon in short order.
Pastor Sue Kesterman is executive director of Churches United for the Homeless, which has been coordinating the efforts.
We're hoping to be prepared for between 30 and 35 out there. We're also working with the former church sheltering volunteers and coordinators to get those supplies taken out of storage, set up over there so that we're ready to go Thursday evening.
Kesterman says at last count, just before Christmas, there were 284 people in shelters in the FM area, flooded to capacity by those seeking protection from the hazardous cold. And a new law designed to protect consumers from massive air ambulance bills took effect in North Dakota on Monday. North Dakota Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried says air ambulance service can be a frequent mode of transportation of patients to emergency medical care in rural states, but many patients are then sent outrageous bills for that service. He says consumers in North Dakota have reported bills totaling anywhere from $20,000 to $60,000. Gottfried says now every health insurance plan sold in North Dakota is required to protect its consumers from these bills.
This is an issue between our insurance companies, their air ambulance providers, and the insurance department, and we can work that through together on behalf of the consumer, but it really shouldn't be left in the lap of the consumer who is coming off an emergency situation and now facing a $60,000 bill on the back end of that. That's not fair to the consumer, and frankly, it's they don't have a choice in this matter. They didn't choose the air ambulance provider. They didn't choose the route they're going to take. So through no fault of their own, they've been facing these, I guess, unreasonable bills.
Gottfried says if a patient does receive an air ambulance bill, they should contact their insurance provider or the North Dakota Insurance Department. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we got a little bluegrass gentle in the background there. Cottonwood playing that, and Jill Weiss with Cottonwood, the bluegrass band from the Bismarck-Mandan area, joins us from our microphone in Bismarck. Hello, Jill.
Hello there. Happy New Year to you guys.
And Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about the 13th annual Blizzard Bluegrass Weekend.
It's coming up Friday and Saturday, January 12th and 13th at Bismarck State College, and the concerts are held in the Sidney J. Lee Auditorium each night at 7 o'clock.
And tickets are what?
Tickets are $15 each, and they are on sale right now up in Washburn at Chase Drug and Java Rose, over in Center at the Corner Express, in Mandan at Cappuccino on Collins, and also in Bismarck at all three music stores, Eckroth Music, Jacobson, and Nightlife, and then hopefully at the door, at, you know, the nights of the concerts.
Well, folks who haven't been around for 13 years to see the previous Blizzard Bluegrass weekends, what happens?
It's just a wonderful event. We our band, Cottonwood, we're from Washburn Center and Bismarck, and we host it. We have a headline band that we fly in from across the country. This year is the High Plains Tradition Band from the Denver, Colorado area. They're going to fly in. One of the best parts of this weekend is the Learn a Bluegrass Song workshop on Saturday afternoon. and this is free from 2 to 4 in the band room at BSC. So we encourage everyone with a violin or a bass or a banjo or a guitar, mandolin, dobro, if they just sing, to come and join us. And it's just two magical hours of learning a song together with really a great, great band out of Colorado.
How did this all get started?
Well, I'm going to tell you, we did not start this. We would never do something like this in January, just for the record, big record. We also helped put on the Missouri River Bluegrass Festival up in Cross Ranch State Park in June. And 13 years ago, we had a band from Knoxville, Tennessee called Blue Moon Rising. And we were their host family and got to know them, and taking them back to the airport on Sunday after the festival. They were flying back to Knoxville. They said, hey, can we ever do a concert in this town we flew into, you know, Bismarck? And I'm like, I'm sure you could. Well, they, can you line it up? And I'm like, no. You know, I'm a nurse, and no, I play in a band, but I'm not a promoter. Well, I started promoting 13 years ago.
Okay.
And so it really was their idea. We would have never started something like this in this time of year. But Bismarck State College has been so generous to let us use this weekend because they're not back in college in school yet. And so really, honestly, every weekend of their calendar year is booked, the Sidney J. Lee. So
well, we started this segment with a little Cottonwood music. Now mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit of the High Plains tradition. This is a cut from their CD, I'll Just Keep On Loving You.
If the world keeps on turning like I'm sure it's bound to do, then I'll just keep on loving you. If the sun comes up tomorrow and a new day comes anew, then I'll just keep on loving you.
But if things well, that's mm-hmm. High Plains tradition, and that's a five-person group just like Cottonwood. How did you pick them?
You know, each year we go to the Miles City Bluegrass Festival at the Eastern Montana Fairgrounds in September. And this year was the 20th annual Bluegrass Festival in Miles City. And High Plains, I feel, has played every one of those 20 years. Their original band members have been together 30 years this year. And, and they're just a wonderful band. I love them so much. They're a great teaching band. And when you're putting on a weekend of a bluegrass festival or this Blizzard Bluegrass, it's really, you always include education of a, you know, song like we're going to learn. You usually try to put on a school concert, which we've done over the years. We've played at several small towns around the Bismarck area. But for the last 4 years, on Friday morning, we take the band over to the North Dakota Youth Correctional Center. The old CIS State Industrial School. And we do a concert for, there's about 90 or 100 kids over there incarcerated. So we'll put on a concert for them Friday morning, free of charge, part of the weekend of, you know, a school concert thing. And then we also donate two guitars to the music teacher, Megan Holkup, over there. And then she teaches guitar lessons to the kids that are incarcerated at the school.
Jill, how long have you been playing the bass fiddle?
Oh, you know, I play the bass. I don't call myself a bass player. I'm a guitar player. But I was the worst guitar player when our band formed, so I had to jump to the bass. And I got to give Joe Andrus a lot of credit, a young man who grew up in Minot. His dad is John Andrus, mm-hmm. who's kind of started bluegrass in North Dakota in our eyes. And Joe kind of helped me along when he was in high school and early years of college years to learn the bass, because there's really not a lot of bass players. So, honestly, about 17 years now, I suppose, I've been dragging that thing around.
And she'll be doing it again this weekend
yep.
at the 13th Annual Blizzard Bluegrass Weekend. That's Friday and Saturday, Bismarck State College in the Sidney J. Lee Auditorium. The concerts start at 7, the workshops from 2 to 4 on Saturday afternoon. Thanks for being with us, Jill.
Thank you so much.
And I love this tune that's also from the CD
yeah.
by the High Plains Tradition.
Oh, they're amazing.
Don't cheat in our hometown.
Okay.
I don't mind this waiting, don't mind this running round. But if you're gonna cheat on me, don't cheat in our hometown.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and horticulturist Ron Smith. Yes, it's cold out there and we aren't doing much gardening, but we're going to talk about it.
We've all got spring fever after all of this. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm wearing merino wool base layer to work. Like this is unacceptable.
We're all layered today.
Yes, absolutely.
In the recent weather that we have had, I don't even know where to go with this question. Is basically we just have to wait until spring to see what survived, or is there anything that we should still be doing?
Basically, to your first question, yes, wait until spring to see what does survive. And there's some good news and there's some bad news. I'll start with the bad news first because it's always better to end up with good news. The bad news is it's going to sort out the marginally hardy plants, those that we think might make it because of the global warming. Ha-ha. You know, Mother Nature doesn't pay any attention to our wishes. So those that are there marginally that are hardy and maybe zone 4 and zone 5, and we've gotten away with growing them in a microclimate these last few years, this year could sort them out and they'll be dead. Trees and shrubs that are weakened by rabbits and insects will also be more vulnerable to die back. At the same time, with these minus 20, 25, 30 degree temperatures over a long period of time, we're going to see some of those pesky insects like the boring insects, bronze birch borer, emerald ash borer, start to die out in the pupal stage in the trees. So that'll make it a lot better for the trees to have some of those pests eliminated that are there. I don't know the whole list that are going to be wiped out at 30 or 40 degrees below zero, but it's going to thin out the population at some particular point. And so it's the intensity and the duration that's doing it to insects, and it's also driving we humans crazy.
Well, you mentioned rabbits.
Yes, rabbits.
Plenty of rabbit tracks out there these days in the snow.
Yes, and I'm having my perennial problem with rabbits, as usual. My wife and I, very cleverly, we thought we have a planting of beautiful shrubs that we're trying to put up between our neighbor and ourselves. Not that we don't like our neighbor, but just to give us a little bit of a definition. Well, last year they ravaged those shrubs right down to the ground, and they came back. So this summer, or this fall, my wife and I went out to one of these handy-dandy farm supply stores, which has everything, and we're looking at putting some kind of a protective screen around this planting of shrubs. Well, we saw the metal and we saw the plastic, and we thought, let's do the plastic. It's much easier to work with, okay? So we go to all the trouble and put up a nice long fence around encircling these shrubs, patting ourselves on the back. We've done it. We've done everything fine. The rabbits aren't bothering it until we got this kind of cold weather, and we noticed that they have about quart to gallon size holes that they've nibbled into the plastic. So if you're depending on plastic fencing to protect your shrubs, either I have the most aggressive rabbits in our backyard in the world because they like to chew right through that, and they go in there and they start nibbling on these shrubs, we're out of luck. So we're just going to go ahead and get some chicken wire or rabbit wire or whatever to put around the base of this plastic fence that we have and hopefully keep the rabbits out. I don't think they can gnaw through chicken wire. At least I haven't seen them do that yet.
Wow.
So it's very discouraging.
Well, when they get that hungry and cold, they'll gnaw on a tree.
They'll go after bark itself. Fortunately, the nice thing about mature trees is the bark is thick enough that they'll tolerate that kind of damage. If you failed to wrap your trees this past fall, you can pretty much count on, and they're young trees, recently planted trees within the last year or two, you can pretty much count on rabbits, voles, finding those and nibbling that tender bark off and eating it. They'll eat just about anything.
They'll girdle the tree and it might not make it.
It might not make it back again. So,
well, let's have some good news.
Yes, yes.
Your mailbox has been brimming full of catalogs.
Yeah, I want to start out by saying if anybody in the listening area has not received a seed catalog yet, email me at Tough Truck, T-U-F-T-R-U-C-K, number1@gmail.com. And I will be glad to send you the addresses of these catalogs, and you will be on their mailing list until death do you part, I guarantee you, especially if you order anything, just a pack of seed. We've got a live customer out here. The other thing I want to talk to you about, my wife is the fanatical gardener, a wonderful fanatical gardener, and so she loves getting these catalogs, and she goes through them meticulously. And if you think, oh, you know, I'm going to try some of these fancy colored vegetables that they have out there. They're pretty neat, you know, Swiss chard, carrots, beets, whatever it might be. Order them now, because she decided she was going to go ahead and order some carrots, and this is back before Christmas, and she called them up on the phone. I want to order this and this and this and this. Oh, we're out of that.
Wow.
What?
In December?
Yeah, in December. It was already sold out. So these rare, beautiful things like these colored carrots, I mean, she thought that was neat, and it is a nice, they have a picture of it here in the catalog. It looks great, but bing, how can they be gone that soon? They don't have a high seed production, apparently, on some of these unique ornamental type vegetables that we like to say, well, we're growing four different colors of carrots in our yard. You know, ha ha, you only have an orange carrot, so... we've got, you know, what's the big deal? We just like carrots. This is the same thing with tomatoes. If you have a variety of tomatoes that you like, in particular, my wife loves Sweet Million, and she has typically a hard time finding it. So go through the catalogs, and if you find a Sweet Million, you like that as a good little cherry-type tomato, order it now, because it'll be sold out very quickly.
So there are fads in the...
Oh, my gosh, yes. Oh, good grief. And it's like buying a limited... And I'll address this to Ashley. A wonderful dress style you have on today, Ashley. Yeah, you got the last one in stock. Okay.
I love when I do that.
Yeah, that kind of a thing. So it's very competitive out there. So, yeah, go to your catalogs. And
you've got a stack of them here.
Okay. Park Seed we have. Burpee Seed Catalog. Johnny's Seed Catalog. These are all highly reputable companies. Young Seed, and that's spelled J-U-N-G, Young Seed, Seeds and Plants, and R.H. Shumway's, catalog. And my wife has something that she likes about every single one of these. So,
So one might be more well-known for its vegetables,
type of tomato. She likes these big beefsteak tomatoes that she can get. And even though everybody claims they have a big beefsteak tomato, my wife has very systematically gone through and found that isn't a beefsteak tomato. It's a good tomato, but I want a tomato that covers a whole slice of bread.
Sure.
Is the way she wants it. So she gets in these orders very, very soon. And when you get the seed, what do you do with it? Do you plant it right away? No. Depends on the seed. If you plant your tomatoes and peppers and things like that, at this time of year, you better have a big greenhouse to go ahead and grow them, because they're going to start and sprout. They're going to stretch. They are going to be totally useless.
Yeah. There isn't really anything you'd want to start this early,
I'm glad you asked that question.
Oh, okay.
What can I plant at this time of year?
Okay,
get started. Things like Lysianthus and Echinacea are good ones for that type of thing. The Echinacea, they have spoiled the purity of that particular plant, that flower. It's a perennial flower. It's a native flower. It's called a cone flower. Years ago, if you can remember, you might be too young to remember this. I'm just kidding, Ashley. You're not that young. how's that for a compliment or
taking it away? Backhanded when it sounded like it.
Anyway, remember years ago, it was a big deal about being healthful and everything else. And so people were digging up wild echinacea all over the region, the upper Midwest here. Well, that's been proven to not be true. And so people now just grow echinacea because it's a very durable, hardy plant. And the rabbits don't eat it. Yes. Hooray. And so they've gotten into breeding these things. And so there's lots of different cultivars or varieties of echinacea out there. You want to start that seed now. Okay. This is a good time to start it because it's a slow germinating, slow growing plant. You know, you get the little seedling up and it will sit there and sit there and sit there. You think, is this going to do any more? You get into February, it's still sitting there. Then you get into March, assuming you have light on this or you have a greenhouse that you can go ahead and be growing it in. they'll start to stretch out and grow and become halfway decent plants. Things like petunias, you can go ahead and start those here in the next couple of weeks. Vinca is a good one to go ahead and start. Impatience is a good one to start in another couple of weeks around the 1st of February. Geraniums, my wife likes to start her own geraniums. So order your geranium seeds, the ones that you want, the colors that you want, the varieties that you want. Hold on to them until about the middle of January, beginning of February, and then go ahead and plant them. And you'll have halfway decent plants to put out when spring finally does get here and the frosts are not going to threaten the plantings outside.
And you're talking about a grow light.
Yeah, grow lights, yes. And fortunately, one of the nice things about any of these catalogs is that they not only have seeds, but they also have grow lights. They have starter kits. They have plant stands, which my wife has down in her basement. Her basement, our basement. She has a basement and I have a basement. Okay, our basement. Okay, and we can go ahead and get those started with heated bottoms, you know, temperature-controlled mats that she gets them started on, and that makes a big difference as far as germination rate grows and rate of growth because you get a good solid root system growing toward that heat, and it only gets up to about 80 degrees, and then it shuts down, the good heating mat, so it's not going to fry your plants. It gets to about 80 degrees.
And I'd never heard of that one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they have them in these catalogs. I'll show you here in a minute. But, I'm talking.
You're going to show the radio audience that. Show you.
Take a look in your. Anyway, so there's lots that you can get out of these catalogs. But don't delay. You know, get the order in, and you will get what you want and not have to say, oh, shoot. How did you get that, Ashley? I tried to order it, and I couldn't get it. Well, Ron, I'm smarter than you are, which is obvious. you ordered it sooner than I did. I ordered it too late. So
what's the advantage or disadvantage from ordering from a catalog as opposed to going down to your nursery and seeing what they have that's, you know, grows in our area?
Okay. If you're a retailer, the biggest thing in your mind, and I've worked in the retail industry with garden centers, the biggest thing you want to have is what are people going to buy? What's the most popular thing? You don't want some strange plant that somebody looks at and says, I don't know anything about that. I'm not going to buy it. Everybody loves wave petunias. If you want to start your own wave petunias, hey, that's great. But you're not going to have any trouble finding wave petunias in the garden centers, the big box stores. So that's the big difference. You're going to see pretty much the run-of-the-mill things, which is there's nothing wrong with them. The garden center, you know, the local garden centers, the big box stores that handle these things, they do an excellent job, and they have more and more variety every year. But at the same time, if you're patient like my wife is, gung-ho like my wife is, you can go through these catalogs page by page. She loves reading them when it's too cold to do anything outside, and the housework is all done, and everything else is done, and there's nothing good to watch on television, and she's bored from reading her book. You can go ahead and go through these catalogs and find what you want.
Okay. Well, we do have some plants inside the house.
Yes, a few
so
of those.
Any tips for the dead of winter care of indoor houseplants?
Yeah. They're very easily forgotten. So they go from one extreme to the other. And that extreme is overwatering them because you always water them on Monday morning, okay, or Saturday night or whatever it happens to be. So don't overwater them. And the other extreme is, when was the last time we watered? I thought you watered them last week. No, I haven't watered them in 2 weeks. Oh, my gosh, how long has it been? Let's see, this is the first of whatever, January, February, March. So check them. And you can also just check them by weighing the doggone things.
Yeah, you can tell when it's
got
water.
Like, whoa, this is as light as popped popcorn. So water them, but don't overwater them. And then when you do water them with tepid water. That's the biggest advice I can go ahead and give you, tepid water, water that's neutral to the skin. If you take that cold water, you don't like putting your hands into the sink,
right,
into the faucet when that water is coming straight out of the cold tap. It is very, very cold. That has a tendency to shock the plants.
All right. Well, if you have a question for Ron,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public.
Next on Main Street, Dakota Datebook.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 3rd. Limpy Jack Clayton was in a world of hurt on this date in 1879. Limpy was a cowboy. gambler, stagecoach driver, Sunday school teacher, and a whiskey salesman. He lived at his dirt ranch on Stony Creek, about 23 miles north of Jamestown. Clayton got his nickname after testifying against a friend who paid him back with a bullet in the leg. 8 years later, that limp got a good deal worse. It happened after Limpy did his part to bring in the new year. When he started for home the next day, he was carrying a heavy internal load of 40-rod whiskey. The temperature was 37 below. One version of the story says Limpy Jack struck out alone on foot and passed out on the trail, but got picked up by a freight hauler and taken home. The other version says Limpy Jack was riding in the back of a wagon, and the driver didn't realize until he reached Limpy's dugout that Limpy had fallen out. Despite the frigid weather, the driver backtracked, found him, and took him home. Either way, Limpy's hands and feet were badly frozen. About 10 days later, Colonel Crofton, the post commander of Fort Totten, passed through on the stage route. Seeing Jack's condition, he ordered Clayton to be taken to the fort for treatment. Once there, the hospital attendants cut his rags off, carried them to the stove on hot pokers, and burned the outfit, bugs and all. Henry Hale, a Fort Totten Army steward, later wrote to Dr. Grassick in Grand Forks, saying, "Jack entertained us for quite a while, but we finally amputated part of one hand and the toes of one foot. We first tried to put him under with ether, but that was only a good jag for Jack." The medical record states that it was impossible to properly sedate Limpy, for just as he became insensible, he stopped breathing, and the anesthetic had to be removed. Ether failed again on a second attempt, but finally, on May 11th, they were able to sedate Limpy with chloroform, and the surgery was successful. And now you know how Limpy Jack's limp got worse. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Mary Helm. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Could meditating for just 1 minute a day help reduce stress and anxiety? Author Dan Harris says yes.
Because the primary insight for beginning meditators is that we are crazy, nuts, insane, that it is a zoo inside of our skulls.
How recognizing that chaos can help change behavior. Plus, a Democratic Party elder makes the case for younger candidates on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, the new Cutting Ed podcast is a collaboration of North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dentersmith. On Thursday, we will feature Cutting Ed host Tom Gerhardt's visit with Governor Doug Burgum, of course, talking about education. Chef Rosie will join us to talk about food, and we'll share our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.